Hello, and welcome to USSOcast, a US Studies online podcast. Here we chat to PhDs and ECRs in American Studies about their research, their life in academia, and all things in between. I'm Sarah Collier, and I'm honoured to be hosting a bit of a special episode today. I'm joined by our very own outgoing co-editor and founder of USSOcast, Dr. Will Carroll. So welcome, Will. How's it feel to be in the hot seat for once?
Absolutely terrifying for some reason. Like, I've sat where you have and also have another podcast, but then being interviewed is really nerve-wracking, but it's lovely to come on, and thank you for inviting me to switch roles for once.
Great. Yeah, well, you can take this, I guess, as your exit interview of being a calling HR manager, and we'll just broadcast it to everybody. So you've been editor of USSO for a year and a half.
Yeah, probably just over, maybe about, how many months would that be? 20 months or so, I think, maybe.
Yeah, so a good chunk of time. And then USSOcast for slightly less, but yeah, as the founding member of USSOcast. You've spent that time finding out all about the wonderful research coming out of the postgrad and ECR American Studies community. But it's about time that you had a bit of a grilling of your own.
Grill away.
Yeah. So yeah, firstly, congratulations again for passing your Viva and finishing your PhD. I guess if you could start by just telling us a bit more about your PhD project and your research.
Yeah, of course. I feel like, I don't know if I've mentioned it on previous episodes, but just because I've been on different things and have written this in various forms, it feels like a paragraph that I've said so many times over this. So if you've heard this, you can just tune out for a bit. Basically my research, my thesis is on narratives of small town America in literature, photography, and art. Particularly looking at the early to mid 20th century, kind of the interwar years is the defining thing. Really, this was just kind of born out of growing up on Stephen King books and loving The Goonies and Stand By Me and basically any media set in and around a small American town. And I just kind of, that stayed with me throughout my undergrad and my MA, and I was writing essays on this sort of thing. And I just realized I wanted to do like a full-blown project on it. And really, it was all about tracing where the kind of contemporary narratives that I like, where did this kind of start? Can I find the kind of origin point? And kind of beyond that, can I conceive of a genre that is small town narrative that other things can be co-opted into? I kind of look at authors like Sherwood Anderson, Willa Cather, little bits of Zora Neale Hurston as well. Norman Rockwell is the visual painter aspect, who's probably the most famous and canonical small town artist. And then I look at the FSA photography from the Depression. So Ben Sharn in particular, look at his street photography. I think if I, in a dream world, I'd love to do like another thesis that looks at like post World War II small town America and kind of the other side of the coin, so to speak. That is really my research in a nutshell, just small town America, three words. It's pretty easy to sum up.
Yeah, definitely. And I really like that idea of the pre and post war as well. There's an interesting kind of dialogue between those two kind of identities of the small town between the wars.
Yeah, for sure.
I guess like my first question would be, what is a small town by American standards?
It's a really, really good and hard question. Looking at like early to mid sociological studies and things that were carried out, I think on like the census, it was like any town with a population of like less than 3,000, maybe. Because there's a real stratification of community in America. You have something called like the small city, which we just don't really have in the UK. What is a town and what is a city are very clearly defined. But like a small city in America could have like 40,000 people in it, but in some ways it also looks like a town when we kind of think of like how they're visualized in film and TV and mythologized in that way. So what I was just looking for was, I started with like the New England village and this kind of idea of the utopian, waspish, very conservative kind of answer to the English village in America. Which has the best way to visualize it really is if you've seen Lady and the Tramp, at the very beginning of Lady and the Tramp, there's like the little church and it kind of zooms out and you see like the snowy, quiet town. That's like the New England village in a nutshell. And then kind of moving west, looking at the Midwestern small town, which starts to get a little bit more kind of expansive in some ways, the Midwest being, you know, kind of flat and well, not all of it, but kind of, yeah, things start to get spread out a lot more. And then even more so looking at the frontier small towns, which are obviously a hangover from like boom towns in the Wild West and things like that. They kind of get less planned and less ordered as the further west you go in some ways. But yeah, for me, is more than anything, as a physical thing, I was thinking, what is a small town kind of spiritually and, yeah, and ideologically as well? And what gives you that sense that you're reading a narrative that's set in and around a place like this, like something like Marilyn Robinson's Housekeeping, or Annie Prue, some of her works, like The Shipping News, like they've just got a real flavor of small town to them. And I kind of wanted to put that feeling that I loved and had been looking at and reading and watching for so many years kind of into words in some way. But I think, yeah, the definition's quite, weirdly quite fluid for something that should be very discreet in some ways.
Yeah, I was gonna say, it's interesting that you sort of trace the differences and patterns in identity across the US. And I was gonna say, is there ever a time when a small town isn't a small town?
Yeah, I think probably when you start getting away from that kind of mythologized utopian New England version of things, which is very clear what is a small town and what isn't. You know, if you kind of go upstate New York versus New York City or something, it's very clear. But then the further west you go, and as you start getting into the Midwest, I think, yeah, little variances and deviations can suddenly change the kind of feel of a place physically and spiritually as well. And one of the kind of notable omissions from the thesis, and if I end up turning this into a book in any way, which I would like to do as kind of a side project in some way, whether or not I continue into academia is probably a conversation we'll have later, but having a book would obviously be amazing. And if I ever do that, I'm going to bring the South in, because this is one of the hardest things in the Viva to defend, like why I'd left it out, because in some ways it feels a little bit arbitrary that it's not there and it should be there. But what I was kind of arguing is that, and this is linked to what you were saying about when a small town doesn't, you know, become something else, the South kind of exists in a slightly separatist, isolated space, particularly in the time I'm looking at, from kind of post-Civil War through to civil rights era. It's kind of existing in its own plane a little bit. And some of the writers that you could bring in there, like Faulkner, and Carson McCullers, who I love, they're just, the feel of their towns is different, and they're not necessarily as focused on the physical construction as some of the other authors I look at. Faulkner's very interested in region and county, but as for the actual like architecture of Main Street and that sort of thing, he's not really that interested in. So yeah, I kind of moved away from the South a little bit, and that's probably the seat of most of what you were kind of intimating, where towns were a little bit more diffuse and harder to define in some ways. But yeah, it's kind of tricky, and it was tricky in the Viva as well. You know, that answer there is probably me rehearsing some of the old lines.
Yeah. How was your Viva?
Actually really, really good. You know, you hear so many horror stories and people just like panicking about them, but then also most of the people I know who have been through them had only positive things to say, so I was trying to internalize that. But yeah, my examiners were Professor Tom Smith at UEA and Dr. Rona Cran at Birmingham, both of whom I knew in some ways before going into the Viva in kind of different aspects. And yeah, they were both really rigorous and attentive, and you know, asked really great questions of the work. And I prepared as much as I could, and a lot of questions I prepared for came up, but there were other questions like religion, how does this factor in, that I hadn't thought about and had to kind of think about on the fly. But yeah, like my manuscript is here, and I was expecting like a year ago to have loads of colored tabs coming out of it and highlighting everywhere. And that's what I see on Twitter, so that must be what has to be done. And I just read through it maybe twice in the 2 weeks leading up to it and wrote a few bullet points down. And that was it. I don't think I looked at the thesis once in the Viva. And I just think that's probably more common than it sounds. I think once you've got the ideas down, you just end up having a really fruitful discussion, I think. And that was another thing about preparing for it. I was thinking, have I done enough? I've only just started reading it like 2 weeks before, but I've just spent 3 years writing it. You know, how much can I do in 2 weeks was what I was asking myself.
Probably a healthy approach rather than cramming.
Otherwise I was just going to burn out, I think.
So your project was so multidisciplinary. I wondered if you had an area that you enjoyed the most.
I love that question because I do. And it is where my kind of postdoc project has come from. Not that I'm accepted on any postdoc applications, but hopefully next time they come around, I'll be sending it off again. Photography is a medium that I have kind of slowly but surely grown to kind of really love and want to take a little bit further. And kind of my new project, really kind of born out of a lot of the stuff I talked about on Small Town as well, is this idea of the photographer as a kind of most attuned in American media to representing loneliness than any other kind of artistic figure, that a painter, a writer, a director. There's something about photography and the act of photography and that kind of isolated figure, kind of nomadically moving around, that I thought was really compelling. And a lot of that comes from just photographers that I collect their photo books of. There's some here, and a lot of American photographers are obsessed with small towns, so there's a kind of natural growth out of that. My MA as well, I looked at film and photography as well as written literature as well, so I think I've just always enjoyed synthesizing a lot of different material together. I find that's quite fruitful. If I'd just done like a single author study or something, I probably just bored myself rather than, you know, boring anyone else reading it. Like, I feel like I needed to be spinning a few plates for more to come out of it.
I can appreciate that as well as a multidisciplinary.
Yeah, I was about to say, I mean, you do it to an even greater extent than me, and I'm sure that's because it makes the work feel new all the time.
Definitely, ways. And every time that you move to a new bend in the road, like a new chapter, it feels fresh to go back to it, definitely.
Yeah, for sure.
Who's your favorite photographer?
Oh god, I literally taught a class on photography yesterday and picked like four that I loved and was trying to get the students to love them as well. I love Todd Heido, and of the four I showed yesterday, he's the only one that's still alive. It was quite a morbid procession of photographers. I mean, two of them like killed themselves and they were really young. So it's very, very morbid introduction to photography. But yeah, Todd Heido, he's kind of known for works, I think Intimate Lives and another book called Outskirts. So he just traveled around kind of suburban America, often taking pictures at dusk of like lit windows in kind of suburban streets. This idea of like life being lived, but we can't see it. We're apart from it. We're estranged from it in some ways. Another series where he took photos from the window of his moving car, and there's like water and snow and rain on the window, so everything gets blurred and aberrated in some way. And I first found his work because one of my favorite authors is Raymond Carver, the kind of American short story writer. Again, loneliness, bleakness, kind of common themes. And I saw a few editions of his books had Todd Heido pictures on the front cover, and I wanted to get a copy of them. I haven't managed to do that yet, but it's just the perfect marriage of material, I thought. Like, they speak to each other so well. I'd probably say Todd Heido, I think. That's a really, really hard question to answer for sure.
Yeah, I know. I hate that question.
I kind of love the torture of it, I think.
And I can only ever think of like Step Brothers. I can't think of anything intelligent to say.
I mean, I love Step Brothers, so you know, I was literally on the Wikipedia page for that last night. That's so weird.
Cool. Tell me more about your next steps. What's coming next?
Oh god, I wish I knew. I mean, I'd applied unsuccessfully for the last round of Leverhulme postdocs to kind of get shortlisted at an internal institution. For those listening who don't know how it works, you get shortlisted at an institution and they get put forward, and then maybe one or two will be successful out of that. I mean, the odds are insane, and I kind of knew that going into it. But what has come out of that is a project proposal which I think is really tight and I'm really kind of happy with, and it won't require much work. when I resubmit it, maybe at different institutions, I just need to kind of tweak that institutional fit. Like, where is there an archive I need to be at? But yeah, like weirdly, in kind of the last month or so, really since the Viva, I've just suddenly broadened my kind of horizons in terms of job prospects a lot more than I previously had. And it's a really tough time to try to get into academia. You only have to look at what's happening with UCU and industrial action at the moment.
Yeah.
It's just so bleak. And a lot of the kind of worst things I'm reading are coming from full-time academics on Twitter. And like, if they can't hack it and it's bad for them, what hope do I have? And, you know, the average look, average wait time, I'm probably looking at, like, if I'm lucky, 3 to 5 years before, you know, from now to getting permanent post. And I think even that is generous, 3 to 5 years. And I've just got to the point now where I've been at uni for 7 years straight. I never took a year out. Part of me just wants to, I've now built a really good CV, which like anyone doing a PhD is building a really good CV, which weirdly in academia doesn't actually mean that much because everyone's got a PhD and everyone's done all these things. So what I'm thinking about is just pivoting to a new industry where that CV kind of has a bit more meaning and worth and weight to it. And I mean, I'm kind of looking all over. I'm looking at law conversions. I'm looking at kind of law contracts and things like that. I've been looking at teaching in some respects as well, which is still, I've kind of always maintained that I don't necessarily want to teach secondary or primary, but I'm not burning my bridges with that. You know, I'm still teaching at a university at the moment. I do enjoy it. So there's some aspect of teaching that I am naturally kind of inclined to do. But yeah, in terms of next steps, I think this year is going to be really formative in getting all my ducks in a row, so to speak, and thinking, what can I apply for? If I make it that the Leverhulme next kind of December, November, January time is the final shot, which sounds a bit stupid because making the Leverhulme your final shot is a bit silly because it's so hard to get. But yeah, I've just, in all honesty and like candor, etc., and you know, this is probably a very common conversation on podcasts like this, I don't expect to be in academia, you know, this time next year. And I don't necessarily kind of feel the huge crushing sadness of that I thought maybe I would a couple of years ago. Like I now think I've done a PhD, you know, I got paid through a scholarship, which I was very fortunate to have. It was just like a job for 3 years, really, that I've learned a lot from and have come out with something I'm really proud of and always wanted to do. So there's no regrets in doing the PhD. And, you know, anyone who's struggling listening that's doing one and is thinking, God, you know, where does this lead? If you're enjoying what you're doing, just keep doing it. But yeah, I think that is probably the honest answer is, I'm not entirely sure, but I think it's probably going to be away from academia. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's really good advice as well, because I think we're probably witnessing a bit of a shift in attitudes anyway, where because I certainly feel the same, where actually an academic CV or experience doing a PhD is so malleable. And I think a conversation is kind of starting to shift more towards the direction of being able to apply it to so many different industries, whereas before perhaps it was just seen as a route into an academic career. But I guess that's the good thing as well, is that there's people tend to be more flexible with the routes that they go down, and nothing is forever in the same way that it used to be.
Yeah, for sure. It's just the stuff you do and the things you learn on a PhD, you're so right in terms of transferability. And just using something like law as an example, you know, being able to research really well, having brilliant written and verbal communication skills, all these are all things, you know, PhDs are learning and are good at. And, you know, there's so much, they take on so many kind of non-law graduates that have got these kinds of transferable skills anyway. You know, I might not end up working in law, but it's just an example of something that I've been thinking about and researching. And yeah, just, it's got to the point where you have to kind of know your own worth and value a little bit. And you think, you just worked so hard for 3 years to get this kind of really great qualification. You know, maybe it would be nice if an employer looked at that and thought, oh, that's pretty good. You know, how can I learn a bit more about this, rather than take it as a given, as a granted, you know, which a university will, obviously, because that's how it works. And yeah, it's just kind of exhausting the very meager positions that come up on jobs.ac.uk and then thinking, do I want to spend the next week writing an application?
Yeah.
And hearing back, well, not hearing back, you know, I've applied, I think, over the last 6 months, maybe to 5 separate posts. And I think Birkbeck were the only university that got back to me in any way.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just a blanket rejection email, but I was like, thank you for emailing me regardless, because like the rest of them are just kind of indefinitely suspended. And I was like, yeah, it's just a little bit draining, I think, in that respect.
Yeah, no, definitely. But yeah, thank you. I mean, thank you for your honesty, because they you know that that's always appreciated on USSO cost. Cool. Well, thanks ever so much for joining us, Will, for your last hurrah on the USSO, although I'm sure we will see you around.
It's been lovely
having you as a co-editor.
No, thank you so much. You've been amazing to work with as well, as of all the other editors. And yeah, really nice to kind of have this exit interview, as you say. A lot more honest than I was expecting to be. But I think, yeah, just a lot of clarity post-Viva. So I'm kind of riding that wave. But no, thank you for having me on.